are actually recording here, right at this, see that neat light meter jump up as we talk here?
Well, that's what I wondered, if there was a light or something to indicate that it's working.
Yeah, we're talking, you see there now, and it's picking it up here.
Is there anything that informs you when the batteries are about to kaput?
No, I don't know.
Have another cleaner this way.
Testing, 1, 2, 3, 4, testing, 1, 2, 3, 4.
Something happened to us on our way to the studio. We met ugly violence, the reality of mass picketing and mobs in the streets. We'd become a target for communists of the communist master plan. They wanted control of our screens for the purpose of disseminating communist propaganda. And now, these young people are target number one for this same communist party. Within the last 2 years, there's been a reorganization of the party's board of directors. They've appointed a youth director, and they're now engaged in trying to make inroads into the minds and hearts of our young people. There's a textbook that's used in indoctrinating or teaching Soviet agents. And on one page, it says, if we could effectively kill the national pride and patriotism of just one generation, we will have won that country. Therefore, there must be continued propaganda abroad to undermine the loyalty of the citizen in general and the teenager in particular. Now, at the same time this evil enemy would deny us our God and our pride in patriotism, he imbues his own youth and those of ours he can reach with a fervor for the false god of Marx and his messiah, Nikolai Lenin. Now, I would not suggest that we could credit the enemy for influencing our young people to the extent of being responsible totally for the poll I'm about to give you. Perhaps it's just reflects the spirit of our times, but several of our large and distinguished universities conducted a poll of young people ranging in age from junior year in high school through junior year in college. They found that 41% of the young people polled believed that freedom of the press should be canceled. More than half of them believed that the government should take over the ownership of banks and some of our heavy industries. And more than 60% believed that profit played no part in the free enterprise system, was unnecessary, and that the government should provide jobs and workers should not produce all they can. 84% of these young people denied that patriotism played any important part in their lives. I can't believe that there had been very much of the influence of junior achievement among the young people that were polled in this survey. Some time ago, I came across a letter that a young American socialist had written to a friend of his, and he was discussing his belief in socialism. And he said, it is my life, my business, my hobby, my religion. I have already been in jail because of my ideas, and if necessary, I am ready to go before a firing squad. We have a cause to fight for, a definite purpose in life. We have a morale and esprit de corps such as no capitalist army ever had. A devotion to our cause that no religious order can touch. Well, if the words of that letter are true, and if there isn't devotion to our cause, then we've betrayed our sons and daughters and been false to our God and trailed in the dust the golden hope of mankind. Now, while I confess to feeling some concern in this particular area, I want to assure you, I am not at all a pessimist. And if I had had any bit of pessimism in me, it would have been eliminated coming here tonight. I'm not hopeless at all about young America. But perhaps there is some reason for concern that maybe you and I, who are adults, haven't done all that we can do or aren't doing enough actually to instill devotion to our cause. The late Judge Learned Hand said, liberty lies in the hearts of men and women. When it dies there, no constitution, no court, no law can save it. When we talk about freedom, liberty, perhaps some of these young people, maybe we've talked in abstract terms. Maybe we haven't made it plain enough to them. Sounds a little like Fourth of July oratory. Well, let me take a clause from the Constitution. We have in our Constitution a guarantee of the right of assembly, the right of free speech, the right to stand up in a meeting and express our ideas. The Soviet Constitution contains a similar clause with the same guarantee to the Soviet citizens. Now, there are some people who say, Well, then wherein lies the great difference? Why all the conflict between the two systems? Well, the difference is so subtle it almost escapes us. But it is so great that it tells the entire story. The Soviet Constitution says, we, the government, grant you these rights. And our Constitution says you're born with these rights. They're God-given and no government can take them away from you. This is the most important part of the heritage with which we endow these young people. This unique nature of the American experiment, unlike anything that was ever tried in the world before, that government exists as a convenience for the people, and that the preeminence of the individual is the highest purpose of government. Yet our young people have seen in recent days Americans trapped for long months in the Congo, many of them killed while we debated the political consequences of saving them. Since World War II, 135 unarmed American airmen have been shot down by a nation with whom we're technically at peace and with whom we maintain friendly relations and diplomatic recognition. Their planes strayed too close to a border, even though they were over international waters, or they were taken off course by a storm. On February 27th, the press reported that Algeria has held an American citizen for 2 months with no charges. He's suffering from a fractured vertebra and other injuries, the result of brutal torture by his captors. Efforts to free him by our diplomats have been unsuccessful. And then we recall an earlier day when a very powerful Moroccan bandit named Raisuli captured a naturalized American citizen of Greek descent, a man named Perdicaris. And our diplomats again tried to free him, and the Sultan of Morocco was afraid to take a stand or to dare the wrath of this great, powerful bandit chieftain. And then a president from the White House sent a message, and the message said, Perdicaris alive or Raisuli dead in 24 hours. And within 24 hours, Perdicaris was delivered to us. It's something of an anticlimax, but it's kind of typical of America, I think, that after we got him back, we found out the bum had forged his papers and wasn't even an American, but we got him back. I don't mean to be chauvinistic or to suggest that we should swagger around with a chip on our shoulder, but that example I've just given was government performing its highest function, pledging the collective support of all of the citizens for even the least individual among us. But this is only one facet. While most people would deny that the folly of Karl Marx could ever be acceptable here, still something of a revolution is taking place and has taken place. Our people have grown dependent on government, and government has just grown. Sometimes I think it's like a baby. It's an alimentary canal with an appetite at one end and no sense of responsibility at the other. Since the turn of the century, the gross national product in our country has multiplied. It is today 33 times as great as it was then. The cost of the federal government is 234 times as great as it was then. 48 million Americans are receiving some form of direct cash aid from government. We're spending $260 million a day. That's $10 million a day more than we were spending just a year ago. And we're letting the young people in on this because part of this we're doing on credit. We haven't balanced the budget 29 out of the last 35 years. We're taxing the productive sector of the economy at a higher rate than any nation in history has ever done without ruin. The late Sumner Schlichter of Harvard, 20 years ago, said the tax history of the United States in recent years has been fairly sensational. A visitor from Mars would suspect that a communist fifth columnist was writing the laws for the purpose of making free enterprise unworkable. One of the proponents of this era of social reform that we're in, a United States senator, says happily that spiritually and economically young people are being conditioned to respond to a liberal program of orderly policing of our own society by government. Well, I think it's time we inform the young people that noble as that particular phrase may sound, what it really means is you'll do as you're told. Now, I'm sure the senator was sincere, and he wants only the best for these young people. But I think at the same time he's lost sight of some of the adventures of growing up and the contributions they make to initiative and resourcefulness and stamina. All of us who have grown up here believe in education. We have a long and honorable history of providing through voluntary gifts hundreds of fine independent schools and colleges and universities. With our taxes, we have willingly built great state institutions of higher education. We've provided jobs and scholarships and nonprofit loan funds to make it possible for thousands of young people of limited means to secure an education. One group today of private citizens is underwriting and guaranteeing the loans from commercial banks to college students, $35 million worth to some 50,000 students. But again, I say, there is a tendency when we turn to officialdom to solve some of these problems to ignore some of the things that we should be watching very carefully. There's a Rotary Club here in a small town in California. It's a college town. They've had a loan fund for a number of years. They help the college by lending money, no interest, to be paid back after the student has graduated and established himself in society. And the other day, the dean of the college called the Rotary Club and said, unless you're prepared to make that loan fund an outright gift, we won't need it anymore because the government is providing money and we don't have to pay it back. Now, today, the government does have such a lending program, so-called, hundreds of millions of dollars with no audit, and they've made no effort to secure repayment, and already the default record is up to 1 out of 6. There are 135 federal offices and agencies doling out money to colleges and college students with an 820-page catalog of goodies to guide them. I think that all of us are concerned with the problem. It's come to our attention recently, the problem of the dropout. Some communities have launched programs on their own to seek a solution. Bedford, Ohio has a community effort of educators and industries that has reduced the dropout rate in that community by half. In Portland, Oregon, citizens and 300 business firms have gotten together for the last several years and have a retraining program where they salvage these young people, retrain them, educate them, plant them in jobs and industries. And a byproduct of this is that every one of the young people they've helped so far has insisted on paying back every penny that was spent on him so that someday they can do this for someone else that needs help. Now, it's proper that government should share our concern in this problem, but again, we see the same indifference to the character-building aspects. Much of the problem of the dropout has to do with the need for earning money at the same time as going to school. So the government goes ahead and in one area alone has a retraining program which they've provided this part-time employment as in addition to retraining, and they've made the rate of pay so high for the dropout that legitimate students who have after-school jobs are now induced to become dropouts because they can get their education and get a raise in pay at the same time. In New York City, they've discovered they've already got a percentage of dropouts from the dropout program. So now they got a new program. They'd retrain the dropouts from the dropouts from the dropouts. But the most startling disclosure that I think we should find out is that these young people, who in a sense have failed to measure up and who are now in a retraining program under the war on poverty, are receiving a higher rate of pay for having failed than the man who puts on a uniform and goes out to defend his country. How do we explain the values of duty and honor to these young men when an Air Force survey reveals that 5,000 Air Force men are today receiving welfare payments, that 55,000 are eligible and too proud to accept it, that 169,000 are paid below the government poverty level and 148,000 of our men in uniform are existing by holding down part-time jobs, moonlighting. Now, you adults here have certainly proved your willingness to give of yourselves and to give of material gifts so that another generation of Americans will know the freedom that you and I have known. And certainly, I don't have the words to commend you enough for what you've done and what you're doing in this program. Why then have I been so presumptuous as to suggest that there's even more to be done by all who are willing to carry the load? Well, in the next 4 years, almost 20 million of these young people will become citizens eligible to vote and help determine policy in this nation who were not eligible in the last election. Either they will demand the right to shape their own destiny, or they will abandon the American Revolution and confess that a little chosen elite in the nation's capital can run their lives better than they can run them themselves. You and I only have a few moments left with these young people, in which we can set their feet on the high road of freedom or see them march toward eternity in a super ant heap. And if the enemy has his way, disavowing God, just soulless freaks of nature, matter in motion in a godless world in his dialectic materialism. Only you and I, in these last few moments, can give them the wisdom so they won't trade their birthright for the soup kitchen of the welfare state. There is a legitimate area for cooperation between the citizen and government to solve the problems of human need. And I'm sure no one would deny that government has its place or suggest that we should leave all of the solutions to just voluntary hit or miss action or charity alone. But let's not go to the other extreme. Let's not go to the extreme that results in such a welfare state that it's the enemy of individual pride and responsibility and initiative, and yes, the enemy of individual freedom, because its inevitable result will be a faceless mass of human statistics waiting for handouts. The barbarians that are at our gate. The last time this happened to a great civilized state such as ours, it was in the 5th century AD, and the barbarians overran ancient Rome. History tells us that every time a cultured society has met the less cultured, the barbarians have triumphed, because with culture has come a certain softness. And the enemy today thinks that you and I have grown soft and that we have raised these young people to be that way. I'm sure that every one of us earnestly prays that never again will a young man in this world have to bleed his life into the sand of a foreign beachhead. But unlike a family quarrel, tragically, it only takes one to start a war. The alternative is surrender. And where but from us can these young people learn the price of surrender? Do we tell them there is an area for compromise? And if so, what do we tell them to give up? Their freedom of choice? Freedom to go where they will? Or should we suggest they give up the right to worship God? Or will we tell them that there can be no compromise between good and evil? That we can't have two sets of standards, one highly moral one by which we run our own private lives, but another one that's a little easier and accepts easy expedience when we adopt the moral shortcuts and so forth, acting collectively as a nation. Thomas Wolfe said, to every man his chance, to every man, regardless of his birth, his shining golden opportunity. To every man the right to live, to work, to be himself, and to be whatever his vision and his manhood can combine to make him. This is the promise of America. An earlier generation of Americans pledged their lives, their fortunes, and their sacred honor to give us that promise. Can any of us do any less? And now to you young people who are here tonight, the help you've received is due to the basis of our greatness as a nation, our voluntary acceptance of responsibility without compulsion. You should remember this night and remember these things that have been done for you and these things which you yourself have done. Winston Churchill said, "Don't be frightened. Don't despair. Keep your head. Strength will be given when it is needed." We ought not to be afraid of running risks. Since when have we learned that we're entitled to security? The only way to avoid risks is never to have lived at all. To defeat, never give in. Never, 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 in nothing great or small. Now, if it would be your wish here tonight to show your gratitude to the men and women who've helped you so much in this program, let me be presumptuous again and speak for them, and I think they would permit me to say this one thing to you. You can best show your appreciation to them by growing up and taking your place in society and then demanding the right to fly as high and as far as your strength will carry you, and pledge that you will carry on the same tradition and make that flight possible for your children. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Regan. At this time, I would like to introduce to you the Monday Night Program Director. This man, who is an accountant for General Box Distributors, is in his second year in junior achievement. In his first year, he was the audit advisor for his company. Ladies and gentlemen, it is with great pleasure that I present to you Mr. Robert Walker.